This week on the Friday edition, Jill Sherman-Warne of the Native American Environmental Protection Coalition.
Hello, everyone. This is Jill Sherman-Warne. I'm the executive director of the Native American Environmental Protection Coalition. HUPA is one of our 31 member tribes. We have 27 member tribes throughout the state of California, two in Arizona, one in Nevada, and one in New Mexico. I work for these tribes. It is a tribal nonprofit that is owned by the 31 tribes. And we're super excited because HUPA, as one of our member tribes, had asked us to assist them with creating a climate adaptation plan. And in that process, we received funding from the State Strategic Growth Council. And we have worked with our partner, the Capacity Collaborative, which is another nonprofit out of the Bay Area that has worked with over 53 tribes nationwide. And I've had the pleasure of knowing them for many years. I would say 20, but I'm trying not to age myself. And they have worked in a variety of spaces, not only with tribes, but also with other small villages in other countries, third world countries. They have a host of experience on climate adaptation, climate prioritization. And so over the past couple of years, we've been working on that and we have been out in the community. And as a result of that, we are now ready to talk to the tribal council about the asset prioritization and hopefully finalizing some of the work that we've heard. We have a list of about 150 priorities that have been identified by the community, or priorities or adaptation measures. And so we're here to talk about that today, share it, let you know that there's opportunities forthcoming to provide additional input. We have a Zoom meeting on Friday, and we will be back having some more meetings in the community in April, April 14th, 15th, and 16th. And so we're just here to talk about that. Sarah, I will turn it over to you and let you introduce yourself from Capacity Collaborative.
Thank you, Jill. I think you've done a pretty good job already. my name is Sarah Diefendorf. I'm with the Capacity Collaborative. I'm the executive director. And as Jill said, we've worked with over 53 tribes, primarily in California and the Southwest, on climate adaptation. We've also worked on water, wastewater, solar energy, all sorts of different issues to help support tribal sovereignty and build tribal sustainability.
Great, great. And we also have your partner here, Elaine. Elaine, you want to say a few words of introduction?
Sure, just a few words. Hi, everybody. I'm Elaine McCarty. I'm Associate Director of the Capacity Collaborative. And just, it's a real pleasure to be here today talking with Jill about the Hoopa Valley climate vulnerabilities and adaptation.
Great. And then I have my colleague, Helen Medina, who's also here. You want to say a quick hello and introduce yourself?
A quick hello to everyone. My name is Helen Medina, and I've been with NAPEC for 20 years, and it's exciting to work with the Hoopa Valley tribe. As Jill mentioned, they are one of our 31 tribe member tribes, and I'm excited about this grant we have with Hoopa.
Yeah. Great. So now we're at the crux. We were supposed to be at the Tribal Council tonight, but as we know, it has now been moved to April 2nd, and we will be in attendance by Zoom on April 2nd to go over the adaptation measures that we've identified or that the community has identified. We're just putting them into the list. And for me, as a tribal member, it's been super exciting to see some of the things that I've personally thought that other tribal members are also thinking. So I don't know if we want to talk, want to share some of those, some of the things that were identified by my fellow tribal members.
Sure. You want me to
jump in? Jump in, Sarah.
So, yeah. so our work with tribes tends to focus on humans, right? Humans mm-hmm. and culture. And there is another adaptation plan for the tribe, which focused on environment and infrastructure. And for us, we spent a lot of time working with the community, speaking to the community, speaking to the tribal council, speaking to the various departments within the tribe. Asking them to say, what's most important to you? What do you care most about when we're facing climate change and we're facing fire and we're facing drought and all of that. If we're talking about protecting the tribe, what matters most? And what always came back to us, first, people. Second, culture.
Yep.
Third, the river.
Yes. Right?
So those are the big three. And so we try to look at everything through the lens, really, of humans. What's most important to protect the people and the culture of the Hupa tribe?
Right, right. And we don't even sometimes, I think, especially in the assessing climate in general, when we hear about that, like we don't hear the state being worried about those things as much, you know?
That's kind of been the problem. The state seems to want us to fix the roads and the bridges. But that's not really, I mean, yes, Hupa cares about the road and the bridges. It gets them in and out, right?
Right.
But really what makes Hupa Hupa are the people and the culture. And
right.
I think it's really hard for the state to understand that.
Yeah, I think anything. And that's what I think you guys get to bring to the table as the Capacity Collaborative, being a part of this process, is you've got to hear this from other tribes. So Hupa is not different in terms of other tribes. Other tribes are prioritizing similar issues, maybe not a river, but certainly their people and culture are important to them.
It's kind of always the same. It's interesting because we've worked with non-tribal cultures and their first focus frequently are like the bridges and the roads, right? And the cell towers. And so it's fundamentally different with tribes, but it's also amongst tribes very much the same. People and culture always rises to the top.
Right, right. Well, because we kind of know we're the only ones we can depend on.
And to be honest, there's more culture here. there's more history here, obviously.
Right.
And there's more community identity as one.
Right.
You work outside of a tribal situation, and the community identity is not really there. Or if it is, it goes back 100 years.
Yeah.
And it's debatable, right? So.
Right. I think just as a tribal member and being able to be a part of this process, the thing that I noticed the most was there was such, when we were talking to like fisheries and the environmental office and forestry, that there were really wasn't, it wasn't like there was, they were connected to the same thing. Like they were definitely connected in terms of being concerned about people and about culture to some extent, but it was like, you know, knowing that there's cyanotoxins in the river occasionally that, you know, our environmental office monitors for, and fisheries seem to have been unaware of that. And I'm like, okay, how is that possible? I mean, anything is possible. But as a tribal member, I'm like, you know, wondering. And I know right now for Hupa, we're going through, we're updating the forest management plan. So I think, you know, there's ways that this work can go into the forest management plan, because when Hupa first developed the forest management plan, which was many years ago, I don't ask me how long ago, but it was long enough ago that a VHS tape was delivered to every single tribal household. Every box holder on the reservation received a VHS tape about the forest management plan. And Hupa's forest management plan has been recognized by like World Wildlife Fund. We've had, you know, we have done, Hupa historically has done many kind of what I would consider cutting edge aspects. And the thing that I've always admired is that we've always been about protecting our cultural spaces. And so in our forest management plan, we have cultural protection zones, and those we've even had that challenged all the way to the Supreme Court. So when I think about Hupa and how we care for the earth and how we look at things, we've always put people and culture first. And so it's always heartening to hear that other people are thinking in those same spaces.
Yeah, so, and I would just like to add, you know, when we were speaking with the Office of Environmental Services, and I'd like to quote this because I just think it's so relevant and beautiful. The person we were talking with said, "You are nothing without the people. People are the foundation. We are the reeds. Alone we bend, and together we hold water. The most important thing to get is more people involved in this process."
Right, right. That's That's beautiful. And I'm glad that, it just makes me feel good that we have those conversations from people who are working in the spaces. And I think everybody out there who is working for the Hoopa tribe, that we do it because we have a passion for it. We are not doing it because we're making big money. we're not the Bezos of Hoopa. We could wish, but we're making good money. And that's what it comes down to. And I think that's the piece that's always missing in like cities, cities and states who are looking at climate adaptation, that they're looking at it from a completely different lens. And so tonight, we had planned that tonight would be the night we would talk to council about the prioritization. Do you want to talk a little bit about the matrix that was created and where it came from?
Yeah, sure. The biggest challenge that we have right now and that Hoopa has is there are about 150 different adaptation measures that have been proposed.
And these are by the people.
They're by the people, yeah. And also, there are a lot more that focus on the environment mm-hmm. and on infrastructure, just because that's what sort of the other consultants were looking at. Mm-hmm. But overall, yeah, 150. Some of them are expensive. Some of them are low to no cost. Some of them focus on the river. Some of them focus on the bridges and so on. So how do we prioritize those, right?
Can you give me a quick example of a low cost versus high cost?
Yeah, a high cost measure would be basically expanding emergency services and expanding, say, the fire department. That was one of the big ones, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that does consistently kind of rise to the top as a priority.
Right.
But it's also going to be probably pretty expensive to add extra infrastructure, hire additional people, all of that.
Absolutely.
A low to no cost would be a mentorship program between elders and youth. Right.
Right.
Prioritizing TEK in education, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Those would be low to no cost measures.
Right.
They're
big ones, though.
Yeah. Exactly. So we have what we call our prioritization matrix, fancy name for basically what's a spreadsheet. But what we did was try to figure out what are amongst all of the adaptation measures, the assets, right? The tribal assets, the things the tribe cares the most about mm-hmm. in order to measure each adaptation proposal against what the tribe cares the most about.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And what we did is you can take this and you can weight it, meaning you can give more to the people, give more to culture, give less to infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of assets, but most of the assets that we tried to incorporate into this were focused on the people, the tribe, the history, the culture. So culture is obviously one. Does mm-hmm. and we look at every single adaptation measure. And we look at it and we say, it doesn't just protect, it makes it better.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that gives the highest score. It fully protects, doesn't really add to, but it fully protects, second highest score. Moderately protects, third highest. No impact, fourth highest, lowest, I guess I would say. And then if it harms, it gets zero.
Right.
Okay. And so, and then we looked at the assets. So we already mentioned the culture, the river, the people. We split the people between elders and youth to add more people. And mm-hmm. we could add even more people to like preschool, high school age, that type of thing. Traditional foods, also very important. And when we looked at the environment, we divided it into two assets, one being the valley environment, which is where most of the people are.
Mm-hmm.
And so protecting the valley becomes incredibly important.
Right.
Outer environment. And then we have broadly infrastructure, but out of that, we pulled homes.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's where the people live, right? That's one of the most important.
Right.
Emergency services, of course, are important. And then finally, cost.
Right.
Because honestly, if you can't afford it, you can't afford it.
Very true.
You can say it's important, but it's something to maybe think about in the future, but we can't do it now.
Yeah.
Right? So you score each one of these based on that. So ideally, the ones that impact and support and build the people, the culture, the river, and traditional foods, homes, all of that rise to the top. And those are the ones that the tribe should address first. That's how we want to try and prioritize everything.
Right. Well, I love that it's driven by the people, you know, driven by the community to say these are the things that are most important to them, because I think that's oftentimes what gets lost. And so it's really hard. You know, I think the group that did the plan, the NCE who did the plan, the bigger plan, you know, it's 150 pages. It's very convoluted. I felt lost in it. Like, what is this really having to tell me? But I didn't really feel like anything resonated in terms of my culture, the people being really what I would call the nuts and bolts. You know, like the car, the overall automobile might be necessary, but it's the nuts and bolts that hold everything together. And that's the people.
Yep. And you know, that's what we're trying to emphasize. A big piece of this, too, is that everybody can see it, right? If you've got all these adaptation measures, you have each one weighed against the most important things that the tribe cares about. All tribal members can look at it and say, oh, okay, I see why this ended up at the top. Mm-hmm. And I see why my favorite thing didn't, or it did, right? It's a transparent process that everyone will be able to look at the adaptation measures, see what they are, and why certain ones will be prioritized by the tribe and certain ones just won't be. It doesn't mean they're not important. It just means that they're not as important at the moment or aren't as impactful on the culture and the people and the tribe.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes it's, you know, things that impact us in our everyday lives, like what is going to be the everyday thing. I think about one of the measures, and there was like shade canopies for homes that, you know, living in a place like Hoopa where you have to have 100 feet, you know, clear from your house for wildland urban interface protections. That means you really can't have trees close to your house. So how do you have any shade from the big heat in the middle of the day? And Helen, you recently had this experience down in LA when you went to went to the place to get some pomade. I know this sounds kind of crazy, but pomade, and their HVAC went out. They had no air conditioning and they were rushing around. They had to close shop and rush around and find a place to put pomade, which sounds kind of crazy, but that's the kind of thing we need to look at. And I know that Hoopa, when we have, having been on the tribal council, people always thought that the reason we had our general meetings in the NF was because we kept it cold in there on purpose. Well, we actually, the HVAC system needs some work on it. So it can't be used as a heating center for extreme colds, and it can't be used as a cooling center for extreme heat. And yet those are the things that we're going to feel, impacts that this community will definitely feel, is increased heat and increased cooling temperatures. And when you have 80% of our homes that are heated by a fire, you know, that it's just like one thing after the other. So we have to think about all these things. And I was thinking about my cousin. Normally, I don't have a green lawn at my house because the water's expensive. And she really worked hard on getting that green lawn. And I had a $900 water bill. I about fell over. But, you know, you have to weigh those things. Like, is a green lawn important? No. To me, it's not that important. I would rather have, you know, green vegetables than a green lawn. It's all those kinds of things that we have to think about. So tell me some of the other, like, nuggets that you were able to find in these adaptation measures.
Well, it's kind of interesting when you talk about the lawn, right, versus the vegetables, because In the larger adaptation plan focused on environment, it talks about sort of protecting waterways, which is, of course, important and all of that, doing an assessment on the localized streams and rivers and all of that. But when we talked to the people, what they asked for was better irrigation for their vegetable beds and their trees and all of that. So it's the same kind of water management. But one is water management for the sake of the water, which
is
not unimportant. But the other one is water management for the sake of the sustainability of the people, right?
Right.
So which is kind of you know, they're different, but you know, they're so that's And I mean, I thought one of the so when we just chose some random adaptation measures, like we said, there are 150 of them. you know, so when we weighted everything against culture, river, food, elders, and so on, youth elder mentorship always popped up top, mm-hmm. very close to the top, because it supports culture, it can support protection of the river, it can support sustainable foods, all of that. Mm-hmm. What I thought, one of the ones that interestingly always drops to the bottom, and I'm not even sure why it's there, but it was not, it was neither good nor bad, just proposed. And the other one was the airport climate assessment. And I thought
that we need that.
Yeah. Well, no comment on that. But whereas, say, the youth elder mentorship program scored like a high of 37, the airport climate assessment was 12.
Okay. Yeah.
So it immediately, like, maybe it is important and it is important to some people, but any tribal member can look at this and say, yeah, I can see why this rose to the top and that one rose to the bottom.
Well, and that's probably indicative of individuals who've had family members who've been flown out from
airport.
I'm sure. That when we have something that's super life-threatening and the Coast Guard has to come in and land, typically, and then mm-hmm. they land and they take people out. So anyone who's had family members who've experienced that knows that if that were to happen at night, we would have to line up our cars to have some lights on the airport, mm-hmm. right? So, of course, we want to know, like, what can we do better there? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's most often used as the diabetes walking area. And not that that's a bad thing. It's just that, you know, I could see why the prioritization kind of slipped, like, or the reason it was even mentioned in the first place.
Well, if it were improving, right? Mm-hmm. Putting in lights or something, it might actually rise to the top. Mm. But this isn't about improving it. This is about doing a climate assessment on how it's going to essentially respond to climate change.
Interesting.
So it's like, well, okay, that's not unimportant, but maybe if instead it was, how do we improve it right now by putting in lights or whatever, constant grading, whatever that is, repaving, mm-hmm. that could push it to the top.
Yeah.
Because then it is starting to benefit everyone. But a climate assessment of the airport.
By itself isn't really.
It just isn't as strong as doing something immediate now. And even then, improving the airport could be too expensive.
Right.
So it may drop because you could actually take your matrix here, your prioritization matrix, and really throw some big scores on cost. Mm-hmm. Right. So if it's low to no cost, something gets 40 points. And if it's almost completely unaffordable, it gets a negative 20 or something, driving things down that the tribe just can't afford.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So it's not up to us. It's up to the tribe to decide how they want to weight things.
Right. Well, and I'm excited that we're able to meet with a couple of tribal council members today to have that discussion with them and hopefully get some additional thoughts on prioritization. But I really think individually they're all going to, culture, people, youth, elders, I think that all will still continue to resonate with them, especially with some of the things that have been happening in the community. And we see that all the time. I think about when I was a kid, you know, we had a lot of cultural activities infused into the school system mm-hmm. that I don't know, you know, I'm not sure how much that happens anymore, but we used to have something called the JOM program and after school activities and a summer program. And I'm not sure where those things are now because I don't have children that age. Mm-hmm. To benefit from that.
And certain things like that have been proposed, mm-hmm. Especially like mentorship and education around climate change and all of that mm-hmm. in the schools. Again, that's kind of a low, no cost.
Right.
So it could easily rise to the top. We didn't weight everything. And then some of the stuff that came in sort of right in the middle were regular health and mental assessments of the community to understand where they're at with regard to climate change, but just in general, where is everyone at and where do we need to focus funds in the future in terms of health?
Right.
So, and I think we heard about putting dialysis machines on HOOPA. So
right.
that people don't have to travel out, you know, something like that.
Well, let's talk about some of the examples, the other examples you can give, to at least describe the difficulty in prioritization.
Yeah. So, again, don't want to overemphasize it, but I will. There's a lot of adaptation choices. So I'm going to read off a bunch.
Okay.
Backup power enhancement for the medical center.
Mm-hmm.
Outdoor worker protection program. Mm. Agricultural fire break system. Drought-tolerant forage program, cost-sharing agreements with neighboring jurisdictions to help manage watershed and so on, a fund for a climate adaptation coordinator position, cultural burning program, trail system and fire breaks, prairie burning program, water storage and water metering, right? So they all sound great.
Yeah.
You know? Who can argue against any of these? But if you try to implement all of them, you're going to go broke. any community would. Electric vehicles for tribal offices is thrown in there, right?
Right.
So, you know, so how do you manage all of this? They all sound good. Nobody's going to look at them and say, oh, that was horrible. I don't want to, you know, they're all good.
Yeah.
So that's why we need to figure out, all right, what is going to help the most in the areas that the tribe cares most about? That's why we're doing this. That's why we're setting up the prioritization program. And that's why we need input to make sure that we're weighting the right things, right? That we're giving the most points to the things that the tribe cares most about.
So would it be easy? Like, I'm trying to figure out how you can, because there's, you know, all these potential measures.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, the weighting. So when we're talking about weighted measures,
mm-hmm.
we're asking individuals to say, all right, what's most important? Culture, people, elders, youth, the river. I can't remember the other ones, but are we asking them to say how many points they're worth?
Probably not.
Okay.
Although, I mean, it's kind of basic right now. For most of the assets, it's very basic. It's, you know, four is the top and zero is the bottom. Yes, we could increase the numbers if we mm-hmm. wanted to give it a stronger weight. But the numbers aren't as important as the categories of assets. If you wanted to give even more power to the people,
mm-hmm.
we would create more assets, right? So that there would just be more points for the people as we move through. So right now, we just have elders and youth.
Okay.
We could actually expand it to elders, youth, preschool, high school, grammar school, working age families. And all of a sudden you'd have like five or six categories of assets that you're weighting against, and you would just get more points naturally for people. You could compress environment to just be environment.
Okay.
Right? And then it only has one little category and one opportunity to get points. So it's almost always going to fall out. Compared to, right? So and the only one that is different is cost, right? Okay. And so cost can, like I said, right now, cost is, in one way, you could keep it in line with everything else, 4-3-2-1-0 in terms of scoring. Mm-hmm. Or like I said before, you bump it way up if it's no low cost, and you bump it way down into the negatives if it's just too expensive right now, right?
I think doing like the no cost, I think you do have to include those two options of no cost and then high cost, and maybe a moderate cost, because obviously in this day and age of where federal funding has been cut for any kind of environment or water. And, you know, I was just at a meeting yesterday or day before yesterday in DC, and we were talking about WOTUS. WOTUS is the waters of the US, and the recent Supreme Court decision and the narrowing of the potential narrowing of the of what is known as WOTUS. And where's the money going to come from?
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, that's the question. Certainly the tribe doesn't have the money.
Yeah.
So we have to look at outside resources, not necessarily from the federal government, but the state government, which California in and of itself has financial woes, I guess. And then there's philanthropic interest.
Mm-hmm.
So are you guys going to, is there you know, in this plan, we've talked about identifying potential sources of funding for some of these things. And so I think having a no-cost, low-cost weighted scoring is going to be helpful with determining how where what funding sources they're going to be looking at.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, including some possible options for funding, I think, is a natural part of it. The problem with integrating funding opportunities into a report is that it's funding opportunities are a snapshot in time.
Yes.
Right? It's yes. Like, yeah, this is available, but it's due in 6 weeks.
Right.
And then it might come up next year and it might not, right? So it's always hard to incorporate that, although I think there's some state money that will continue to be available in the coming years. Federal money, that's a crapshoot. Who knows what's going to be out there and what's not?
It's getting harder. Helen and I were last Sunday night, we're working on a grant. It was like due at 5 p.m. on Sunday, which is kind of an interesting deadline, but didn't know about the opportunity until late, and it was a pretty quick turnaround. So staff have to be ready for those things too.
Absolutely. So federal grants are a nightmare.
Yeah, you don't have to tell me.
That's another show.
that is another show for another day. But the no cost, I think, looking at just how the tribe can potentially rally their resources to implement no cost efforts, I think that would be really helpful.
Yeah, and right now it's no and low cost are lumped together. You can separate it out, right? So no could be 60, low could be 40, you know, and so as you start to get into any kind of cost that could take away from other programs, require writing federal grant proposals, all of that, start to really lose points, right? So that what can you do now? What's within the budget now? Or what's just a minor tweak in order to be able to accomplish it?
And that
actually is attractive to funders as well, or at least not so much federal, I think, but for sure state and for sure philanthropical. They love to see the no low cost stuff. They love to see matches. The resources are already there.
Right, and I think a grant writing hint would be that when we're using resources like elders without compensation, that still has a dollar value to it. And I was just having this conversation with a contractor that we work with that he needed to increase. I know it sounds crazy, but he needed to increase his contractual fees because they said you have to have, he wanted to do things for free. And I'm like, no, you have to have it's a value. Don't charge mileage to go to the post office because you're going to the post office anyway, you still have to still consider those costs. Mm-hmm. And so all of those things have a value that you might not otherwise think about.
Well, and even beyond that, I mean, if you are engaging the community, it's oftentimes hard to convince, especially public funding, federal and state, that the people that are participating in your whatever it is, work group, interview sessions, whatever, they should be compensated for their time.
Right.
That's only fair. And it's often treated as though, oh, well, I don't know what, they should be lucky for being able to put in their input. I'm not quite sure what the thinking is, but it's often that, if people have to drive, compensate them for the mileage and for the gas that they're spending, feed them something and maybe give them a little, $100 gift certificate to Safeway, something to compensate them for the time, because they're giving you the information you need to do the report and fit the parameters of the grant you received. They should be able to get compensation. But sometimes you put that compensation out there and then the funder says, yeah, we don't cover that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. All the time. That is a big one, especially in Indian country when you're talking about having to you want to put in to have a light snack, but you can't put in having any kind of snack. And it's like, it's an issue of public health at that point, because we have so many people who are diabetic within our communities that they absolutely, for a 3-hour meeting, they need to have a snack. They need to keep their blood sugars balanced.
Yeah.
So I don't know if we could put a medical thing in there, but that's an idea that I've always played around with. Anyway, give us some more examples of the measures.
Okay, let's see. Well, we did the airport climate assessment, but community facility hardening, which could be hugely expensive or not, depending.
What do you mean by hardening?
I would imagine
making it stronger.
I mean, it could be anything, right? It could be removing foliage and things away from a building, but then it could also be resurfacing a building with like hardy board, which is something that is almost impossible to catch on fire. Put metal roofs on all the buildings, right? That type of thing. But one, removing the foliage is affordable. Two, putting metal roofs on all the buildings is not. That's really expensive, right? Microgrid feasibility study.
Yeah. And I know that they've done some microgrid feasibility studies here. So that's happened.
So, yeah. And so in some ways, like when we go through this list, ideally, we might be able to mark some off because they've already been done. And so you can already tell people that you're practicing climate resilience and all of that. An emergency operations center.
What I saw when we were going through this process is that many of the there was a lot of siloing with the departments. And so there wasn't the communication. Here's what I have. Here's what you have. How do we put it together to, for example, be responsive to an emergency? Is that something, because did you say that there was a climate adaptation coordinator in that's as an idea?
Yeah, that's one of the adaptation measures was to hire a climate adaptation coordinator who would, you know, obviously coordinate between all of the different departments. But that's another paid position.
Right.
And it's also requiring all of the departments themselves to be constantly monitoring and updating their climate adaptation planning and integrating it all into a single plan. And that's on top of the watershed management plan and the forest plan and the housing plan and the, you know, so it, there are a lot of plans.
We love our plans.
I know.
We have plans.
Government loves plans. So, yeah, I mean, it's, the devil's in the weeds, right?
Yes.
And in the details.
Yep.
And so it's hard. Silos are not unusual in government.
No, that happens throughout. I haven't worked for a tribe that didn't have department silos, that, you know, department silos, but that's where your administration, like an adaptation coordinator would kind of come in. And I know that the council does want to have these kinds of conversations. I don't know if they still do it, but they were doing monthly meetings with their managers and having those discussions. But I think having targeted discussions, and maybe this is where this could potentially help with, like, here's some areas where we should have some targeted discussions, because we brought up irrigation, right? Improvements to irrigation for people in their home gardens or home gardening. And I have a irrigation faucet in my front yard that has yet to have water in it. I mean, like, as far as I know, there's never been any water flowing to it. So it's like having to use potable water, which I hate to do because you have to pay for that, but potable water to water your vegetable garden. But you need to water vegetables in the summer when it's, you know, gets up to 119 days in a row, you have to have that. So how do we go about improving those systems? How can departments come together? And this is where it's also important for tribal departments to have the exposure to what other tribes are doing, because I know that another tribe in Southern California, they needed to have a they were trying to protect a stream, but someone's cattle was using the stream to drink from, right? And so the only way they could do that, and they were very clever, they said that they needed a well for fire protection, which they did. So they dug a new well and they put together water for the cattle to keep them out of the stream, but how they got it funded was that they needed it for fire protection. They needed a new well. And so it was like, sometimes you have to think out of the box like that. And I just thought that was a fantastic way of getting what they needed. I mean, it was twofold, right? Yeah. They really did need the fire protection. It really was necessary to have that extra well, but it served a dual purpose. And I think, you know, if you looked at it from a perspective of like two different departments, you would have the fire department and then you have the land management agriculture department. And it's like, could those two have really had a conversation together? And, but if they did, this would be the perfect solution for something like that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Did we have anything about agriculture in there beyond home gardens?
I'm going to look. I think we did. I mean, there's a lot of information. I'm sort of going down the list. Agriculture and rangelands. So acorn tree protection program.
Oh, okay.
Plant and monitor indigenous gray pines. Agriculture water efficiency. So irrigation improvements and metering. Mm-hmm. Drought-tolerant forage program, agricultural firebreak system, rangeland water development, and climate-adapted grazing management plan.
Wow. Wow. Rangeland water development. I like that. That's exactly what I was saying with the new well for fire protection, that they dug this well for that particular purpose. But the added benefit was having a place for cattle to go and take a drink of water.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, there was something you mentioned in there that made me wonder if there was a conversation. Can you read that again real fast?
The list?
Yeah.
Climate-adapted grazing management plan, rangeland water development, agricultural firebreak system, drought-tolerant forage program, agricultural...
It was the acorn protection.
Oh, acorn tree protection program.
Yes. Yeah. I know that being on the tribal council... Having been on the tribal council, there was a lot of concern about tan oaks being chopped down, harvested.
Okay.
I'm not really sure why they were being harvested, but there was concern from people saying, hey, and so it's good that it ended up in there because that was something mentioned by a variety of tribal members being like, how are we going to protect our tan oaks?
And that would actually, given how important it is to culture, traditional foods, people, elders, youth, the valley environment, all of that, it would probably rise very high on the list.
And it would be, I think it would be no cost, personally.
Probably.
You're not asking anyone to take time to saw something down. Which, you know, so you're not paying someone to saw it down, you're keeping it. So, you know, again, I think that no cost, low cost, like those two are two definitely categories that should be used to in prioritization personally.
Yeah.
Hopefully others feel the same way.
And
you've also got some other adaptive measures mentioned, like water storage and water metering and groundwater well development that then are factors in these other assets like agriculture, which is what you asked about. Mm-hmm. So how those adaptation measures get prioritized and the points that are assigned to them matters. So it's all interrelated.
Yep.
And that's why it's so important to get feedback from the community, especially on the assets that are going to be measured.
Yep.
So I guess maybe we'll have to do another radio show to talk about those issues so that people can have a way. And this is what's exciting right now is we're in this process of gathering community input and feedback. We will be advertising things in the Two Rivers Tribune. We will have a link for a prioritization, I think is what we talked about, helping us determine how to prioritize these assets, and we'll be giving you the opportunity to also apply for an incentive drawing as a part of that process, and then also having just these meetings with the community advertised. We'll do a lot on Zoom. I think that will be really helpful to make it easy for people to participate and not have to leave their home or whatever. Just call in and, and listen in and participate at
Absolutely.
Your will. Don't have to give your name. You can be, you know, do it as a private citizen too. Stay off camera, dang it. We don't need to do those Facebook lives. But, you know, so over the next month, we're going to be back and to do some public meetings in April 14th, 15th, and 16th. And we will be doing they're handing me the Zoom link tonight, which if you go out and buy a Two Rivers Tribune Or no, it's tomorrow. Sorry. If you go out and buy a Two Rivers Tribune today, you will see on page 7 is an advertisement to discuss the adaptation priorities. And tomorrow at 10 a.m. on Zoom. And I don't know. I'll give you the meeting ID number and passcode.
Okay, so this will run on Friday, so you can say today.
Okay.
Or alternative, just Friday.
Okay.
So you say Friday, they'll be there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll invite you to a Zoom that's happening today at 10 a.m. And if you open up your Two Rivers Tribune and turn to page 7, you'll see the advertisement for that and with all the information for the meeting ID and passcode. And then again at 6 o'clock tonight. So two opportunities to come say your piece. And of course, we will be advertising more opportunities for you to come say your piece and be able to participate in the prioritization of the measures that have been identified. And, you know, if there's a measure out of the almost 150 measures, you can add it in, slip it in there. Maybe there's something we've missed. I don't know. It's pretty extensive, if you ask me.
It's extensive, but honestly, it's okay. If it's already been said, it's already been said. But if it hasn't, we get to add it in. So it's not like you have to review all 150 and try to figure out, is my adaptation measure in there? You don't have to do that. Just let us know what you think the tribe should be doing, what it needs.
I just thought of one.
Yeah.
Installing clotheslines for all households. Because it's a low cost. It's not a no cost, but it's a low cost. And it would be, helping on saving your electricity bill in the summer. So you can use that savings towards maybe running an air conditioner. I don't know. And not your drying machine.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
So I'm like, that would be an idea. I don't know. Maybe nobody else would think
but
that.
We'll have a place for people to submit ideas that they can add. Like I said, they don't have to review the list. They just add what they want. It might already be there. That's okay. But it might not. So,
right.
And we want to add.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think two brains are better than one and, you know, 100 brains are better than two. So the more the merrier. We want people to comment because this really is going to be up to the HOOPA people to use and ensure that it carries on. Because the other thing is it doesn't always have to be the tribal council to do this, right? There could be small community organizations like the Fire Safe Council that could use this document to access funding to implement fire safety measures. Mm-hmm. And so, or departments individually. So it's a useful tool, in my opinion, for community organizations to use, as well as the tribe to gain those funds.
Yep.
So free for all. Now, getting the money is a whole nother animal.
Yeah, always is.
Any suggestions for that? Like, you guys are such successful grant writers. I know. It's a lot of work. I mean, I don't want to downplay how much time and energy is spent on that. But, you know, are there suggestions for those newbies coming in?
Oh, my gosh.
I just say do it.
Do it, but do it with some support from people that have done it before.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you're not going to win, more than likely. If there are things like federal grants or even foundation grants, like there are tricks of the trade.
Yeah.
And Jill, you're one of the people that can help them with the tricks. And that was maybe the wrong way to say that. But anyhow.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's honestly like find some advice from people that have gone through it before. That's always the best way to do it.
Right. Yeah. And it is a full-time aspect of anyone's work to look for that additional funding to get sources out there.
Mm-hmm.
Elaine, is there anything else I missed? I think you've contributed some good parts to this.
Well, I would just add what I was thinking about in the regards to funding, especially mm-hmm. for the tribe, is to really collaborate more and cross-pollinate on those funding ideas and those funding applications and actually leverage what grant writing skills you have here already.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's where you use your I'm glad that you pointed out the collaborative efforts, because Northeastern Humboldt County is a unique, which is where HOOPA is a unique kind of niche, because we provide the additional fire. We provide the additional emergency service. It is HOOPA that it provides the ambulance, not only for HOOPA, but for all of the outer regions. And so we don't play up enough. I think the tribe doesn't play up enough how much of an asset they are to the Northeastern Humboldt County. And so it'd be cool if we could get Humboldt County to support some of the tribe's efforts, especially in this, because if we're talking about emergency services that are rising the top as a part of our climate and adaptation measures, then the tribe is a very good partner and is, just a waiting partner, I guess.
Yeah. There's regional opportunities there, for sure.
And I mean, Blue Lake is actually a really good example of a tribe that has come to the forefront of being able to protect all of their neighbors in times of fire, in times of storms, when the power goes out, all of that. They've become just totally integrated into supporting the community because they've got those solar panels.
Yes.
And they can run things without the grid. So partnership is amazing.
Yeah, it's really hard to plan to do things here. You know, most of the time our backup generators are not for days on end. They're for a few extra additional hours. Mm-hmm. And so we need those sources that are going to be able to be viable for up to a week in my mind. I don't know. Did the measures talk anything about like that specific? Because I don't think anything super specific.
I don't think anything goes into, how much time are you in for when something happens. I mean, I certainly know that we're in the Bay Area. We've pretty much been told that when the major earthquake hits, be prepared for no one to contact you for at least 2 weeks because they're going to be too busy helping, all the major infrastructure spaces and digging people out and all of that. So you, little household here in the Oakland Hills, be prepared because we're not going to be there. So for at least 2 weeks.
So does that mean you're a part of a CERT team?
No, we just have a lot of freeze-dried food.
Well, I'll give a little plug for NAPEC. These are trainings that the Native American Environmental Protection Coalition is getting ready to roll out. CERT training, 40-hour HAZWOPER training, PFAS training. We are doing that. They are boot camp style, so you do have to come to where the training is being held, which one will be at Paula, one will be at Pechanga, one will be at Rincon. So we, you will have to come to Southern California. And the reason it's in those spots is because they offer their facilities to us for free. We just pay for the trainers to show up. And CERT training, which I am certain that the Fire Safe Council probably would be interested in doing, is really about creating community emergency response teams so that we can respond to our own needs and our own selves.
And that's actually one of the adaptation measures that's proposed for HOOPA is a community emergency teams.
Right on. So, again, it's not just about the environment and the plant, that it's not just about Tanux. It's about people, culture, community. And that's what's exciting about it.
You know?
I think doing climate adaptation is really about doing being a resilient community.
Mm-hmm.
And is no matter what the history is, right? We just kind of get in there and do it. But again, ladies, so fascinating. You get your knowledge. You're always dropping knowledge on me and dropping, you guys know how to do this stuff. And it's not any easy task.
No.
Anything else? Anything in closing?
Just remember, climate change is an amplifier. It's not something new in a way. It's something that you already know about, but it will be bigger, better, more significant than it used to be. But you kind of already have the tools, right? You have the knowledge. It's all about the knowledge is already there. You just have to implement what you can.
Yep. HOOPA people have always been resilient. We'll be here for the next the end of time. We were here at the beginning of time. We'll be here at the end of time. So thank you, ladies. Thank you. Thank you, KIDE. Don't forget tonight the Zoom meetings that you can listen to. Don't forget April 2nd that we will have a presentation at the Tribal Council meeting, and we will be back to bother you April 14th, 15th, and 16th in Hoopa.
We've been speaking with Jill Sherman Warren of the Native American Environmental Protection Coalition. She was joined by Sarin Diefendorf, Elaine McCarty, and Helen Medina. If you need to know more information, you can check their website. That's NAPEC, NAEPC.com. The Friday edition is a public affairs presentation of KIDE Hoopa Tribal Radio. We thank you for listening.